all, not wait for weeks. I want him to be gainfully employed. When I spend his cash, be not annoyed. Pulls out my chair and opens my door, massages my back and begs to do more. Oh, for a man who makes love to my mind and knows how to answer, how big is my behind? I want this man to love me to no end and always be my very best friend. Male poem. I want a deaf mute nymphomaniac with huge boobs who owns a liquor store and a bass boat. And I know this doesn't rhyme and I don't give a...
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. That last one sounds like Maya Angelou a little bit, yeah. But oh, by the way, so we're listening. By the you're listening to the Are You Crazy show, and it's just after 8 o'clock on the Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio Station. My name is John Case, and my good friend and co-host Dr. Zaki McGill is here. We have Mike Diesel, who's a frequent commentator and a voice of many voices of many people.
Good morning, everybody.
Is on the phone. And our guest this morning is Dr. John Aldous, who I call him the prescription for addiction.
That's a good one. All right.
Anyway,
I'm going to use that today with the chief of police.
Anyway, and so why don't we officially welcome John and start that part of the show.
Welcome, John. John, you're a legend already in this area, but and any kind of thumbnail portrait you'd like to paint for our listeners this morning?
I was asked quite a few interviews ago if I would come here and give progress of what's going on, what progress are we making. And while they keep asking me to come back, I'm not asking you to come back because I'm not seeing a lot of progress. The overdose rate is serious and not getting better. The access to medication-assisted treatment is not better. The emphasis on non-evidence-based approaches to management of addiction are still very popular. And the voices of evidence-based treatment simply aren't loud enough. It's just me sort of shouting in the wilderness sometimes. And this is pretty unfortunate. People say, why us? How did this happen to us? And then you look at the answer is perhaps embedded in the fact that there is no needle exchange program. Access to treatment, medication-assisted treatment, evidence-based treatment, six-month waiting lines. A whole host of managements, treatments, which are considered standard. Naloxone availability. I think I'm the only one giving the talks regularly around here for take-home naloxone Narcan programs. These things which the government and, well, everybody in medicine says, these are critical components to managing the opiate addiction. They're not here. Are they so poorly represented here? So, yeah, not a lot of progress. So that was a downer. I'm sorry for that.
Why?
I think when I try to reach out to people, to journalists, to discuss, get an interview, so when they use the word treatment, they know what they're talking about. Or they know this component of treatment, the standard evidence-based approach to treatment, and I can't even get the interview.
What's the difference? Give me an example of evidence-based versus non-evidence-based approach.
Okay, evidence-based is what SAMHSA, DEA, FDA, CDC, everybody says is medication which assists the treatment. The treatment is not the medication. The treatment is psychosocial counseling, hopefully some case management, hopefully helping these individuals get jobs and getting their license, driver's license back in their cars and getting their lives together. But it's based on the medication is needed for those things to happen. And there are three forms of medication. That's Vivitrol, which is an injectable naltrexone drug. It's given a shot, given once a month. Another medication is methadone, a very effective treatment, which of course, like all the other treatments, has its problems, but it's a very effective treatment. And the third one, of course, is Suboxone, the strips. That has its problems too. All three have their problems. But without the medication, the treatment is, the efforts toward treatment, the efforts to keep people in treatment, is pretty meaningless in a lot of cases. Now, when it works, my goodness, I'll be the first one shouting hallelujah. You know, that's fantastic. If you can talk a person out of their addictive behavior and give them enough support and give them the jobs and give them their lives back without medication, fantastic. Everyone's happier.
But what's the ratio? What's the like? Give me some data points on that one. I mean, out of 100 addicts, how many will that method save versus how many with some combination? I mean, how do you need to when you say evidence based, you gotta evidence base the last part of it.
That's right. Okay. And your question is right on target, and I don't have the answer that's right on target right in front of me. Okay. Yeah. There's a lot of data. There's a lot of numbers, a lot of information out there, and I can't spout it off right now. I do know that when they look at things like comparing medication-assisted treatment to rehab programs, you put a person in a closed facility for 3 weeks, 6 weeks, 12 weeks, whatever, and see how they do after that. That doesn't work well. That's a high, high failure rate. Right. Okay,
like in the above, like way over half type thing.
Oh, way over half, 85% failure.
Yeah. Okay,
so. Yeah. 85-95%. So you then go to jails. You put them in jail for 2 years. No narcs at all for jail for 2 years. Mm. Well, that should work. You've got them off their narcs. And then they walk out the jail door and walk straight to the street corner to buy some more heroin.
Yeah.
So they've had no treatment during that 2 years. Now, if in those 2 years, in that jail sentence, you could put them in counseling and have NA meetings there and have good psychosocial counseling going on, you may accomplish something with that. Again, good question. That's going to be your next question. What's the data? What's the success rate on that? I don't know it. Those are good questions. And the next time I have an interview with you, I'm going to have some reports and give you some answers, because those are fair questions. But it isn't so much that we know that medication-assisted treatment is successful all the time. That's not true. It isn't. We just know that whenever it's compared to anything else, it comes out better.
Right.
It's also more expensive.
Let me chime in here, because I don't have the raw statistics on this either, or refined statistics, but in my experience practicing in Florida and California, people who go through a rehab program and do not get significant medication assisted treatment only succeed if they're in a 6 month to 1 year follow-up aftercare housed program, okay, where they are every day exposed to group therapy, to counselors, to other people who are trying to stay clean.
We had someone here one time on one of those local houses, didn't we? That there were they
right?
Like yes,
yeah, we did. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oxford House.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah,
but you know, Oxford House is unique in that that's a little looser than the ones that I'm familiar with that were successful. But yeah, I practicing in Florida at that time out in the boonies, out in the Everglades, edge of the Everglades, where we basically had to send people away to a long-term residential treatment program when we could get a bed. It was like, it was significant that if they had at least 6 months to a year, they did well.
One of the responses I have to that is, so you have 100 people that you try this treatment on.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 5 of them did the full 6 months and did that 5 does well.
Right.
But the 95 then gets dropped off the statistical table all of a sudden. We stop talking about that.
The other thing is that it's damn hard to get someone to sign on. Absolutely. For 6 months to a year. I mean, the average person just cannot give up family, you know, job, etc. I mean, these, yeah, it's a skewed sample. I agree. These are people that are just really down and out. It failed a whole every other program. Families abandoned them. They don't have anything else to lose in the world. So they're like, well, okay, I'll go away for 6 months.
Jerry Garcia and Gerald Ford's wife, you know, we're in one of these fancy places together at
okay,
and she was she was purportedly trying to tell him that there was something to live for after heroin, and Jerry wasn't sure.
The first lady telling him there's something to live for. Mike, are you chiming in?
Well, yeah, just I wanted to make it's tough for a lot of reasons. I mean, it's kind of fresh for me because a guy I read, and I didn't get a chance to meet him. I met Bob Seska, writer for the Daily Banter and also Daily Beast. He's also written for Huffington Post, and he did a podcast with Ches Pazienza, who was just a, you know, John would probably describe him as a bomb thrower, but excellent writer. He recently hadn't shown any signs of relapse. About a week and a half ago, I think it was, went out to his car and, lit up heroin and died of an overdose.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody is still very, the feelings are still very raw. So it's, you know, I don't know what you do in that situation. I don't know, you know, it had been, I think, by all accounts, his fiancée was completely unaware of any type of relapse into heroin. Now, he did occasionally slip back into some alcohol consumption, but not a great deal of it. He was trying to be even, you know, expressed to her he was trying to be disciplined, but he was so, I think, distraught based on what happened in November that he just never really got over it.
What happened in November?
November 8th.
Oh, November 8th. Okay. No. Mike, I want to make a comment, and then I know Dr. Aldis's eyebrows raised, so I know he wants to weigh in too.
Yeah, well,
number one, I just want to make the point that addiction, like cancer, is a terminal illness. Okay, it's got a horrible death rate, a horrible prognosis, but some people survive. Some people go into remission, then they come out of remission. Some people come out of remission and they stay in remission. But we have to remember addiction, like cancer, is a terminal illness. John, you're on.
Well, actually, life is a terminal illness, so we can broaden that a bit. But you're absolutely correct. This business of alcoholism with other addictions is a very, very troublesome issue. And I've known many people in addiction who get their addiction under control and their alcoholism takes off like crazy. That's why the treatment is not the Suboxone. The treatment takes care of their opiate addiction, but doesn't take care of their addiction writ large, doesn't take care of the fact that they've got some other addictions going on. First of all, of course, smoking and nicotine and tobacco is a big one, but the alcohol sometimes takes over their lives at that point. That's why the ongoing counseling is terribly important. If you don't have that component as part of the treatment, you're not really accomplishing much of anything with the Suboxone. The other story, the gentleman you mentioned who was supposedly clean and went out to the car and OD'd and died.
Right.
Of course, there are two or three things going on there. First of all, he'd probably been off opiates for a long period of time. So he'd lost his tolerance. So even if he got the normal stuff, I think they call it the good heroin, which I always find it's oxymoronic there. But today there isn't any good heroin. It's all mixed with the fentanyl and cofentanyl and everything else you've got in the book. So he may have injected something. He had no idea what it was.
Yeah, right.
And so the third thing is, if in fact he was close to a relapse, how willing are these treatment programs to take these people back in under their care again? These programs usually say, look, I've got a six-month waiting line for people who haven't been in the program before. They're all in front of you. You go to the end of the line if you've relapsed, if you've been good for a while and you relapsed. This is the wrong way to do it. We have to capture those people who've done well in the program, They go out and then they screw up and they need to come back in again. We have to bring them back in a caring, supportive way. And my own experience, that's not happening often enough. We're letting these people flounder around on the 6-month waiting line, and sure enough, a lot of them die.
And one of the most disturbing things that John has shared with me is, clinics where they underprescribe. It's like, if I have prostate cancer and, the appropriate dose is 100 milligrams of something every day. But let's say that, the doctor said, but this has the potential for addiction. So I'm going to give you 50 milligrams a day. I'm like, are you crazy?
The name of this show.
You're going to save me from becoming addicted at the risk of under-treating my prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. Give me a break. John?
Yeah, that's, the standard of care. What's recommended? The standard of care, the doses for these medications, Suboxone, Vivitrol, Methadone, the doses are pretty well established. There's a lot of literature, and yes, the doses are written up by the drug companies. I realize that. I realize there's a sort of a cross message there that the drug companies want to sell more of the stuff. I realize that. The fact is that good studies show what is the evidence, what is the dose. This is a chronic, like Zaki says, a chronic disease. They will have it for probably many, many years, and trying to get them off the medication as soon as possible is like trying to get the cancer patient off the cancer treatment as soon as possible, or trying to get the diabetic off the insulin as soon as possible, or trying to get the schizophrenic off the medicines for schizophrenia as soon as possible.
Which is not the right approach.
No, it's not the right approach. When someone has a major depression, back when I was early in my practice, there was this idea, well, get them on the medication, get them out of the depression, and then start weaning them off of
right.
it, as soon as possible. Well, we found out that when you do that, 85% relapse within the first 2 years. So, we had to revise that. Okay, then they should, when a patient would come to me who was very medication skittish and say, I'd really like to come off of this, I would say, well, here are the statistics. Here are the, this is the trend. If I could take you off the medicine, but your risk of relapsing is 75%, 85%. And most of them would say, okay, then I can just coast with this for a couple years because it's not that bad. Some of them would say, I still want to get off. So then I'd say, okay, I'm willing to help you get off, but we're going to do it very, very slowly.
Excellent.
If they've been on it for 6 months, we're going to take 6 months to wean you off of it, okay? Not 1 month. Which was the usual protocol back in those days. I mean, we learn as we go.
And if they have a problem after that, be an open door that you want them to come back, and you let them know you want them to come back. When they do come back, you welcome them, and you continue the treatment. You continue the treatment. You don't restart the treatment. You're treating a chronic disease, which needs chronic management. And so the patient made a wrong decision. You were excellent in advising the patient what the statistics were, the data was, and they made a decision, and you supported them in that decision, but you also supported them when things Absolutely. Didn't go well.
Yeah. Like punish them because they said, well, I'm depressed again. I mean, how crazy is that? Well, you decided to come off of it. I told you not to. So now,
Well, I think it's a great thing that you guys, I understand you're going to be meeting with police chief in Martinsburg about this matter.
Maury Richards.
And I think that, two things occur to me. One is, I think it's very important to try to establish, if you can, a professional, a very strong professional argument, as well, and hopefully a consensus on that, and the data should enable you to do this, okay? It should. About what's the effective difference between one philosophy of treatment versus another? Because let's say if you have 100 addicts and the cost of doing nothing
is measured out in terms of crimes and all the other issues and that happen. And then the cost of doing plan A saves 5%. But if positive during plan B or your plan, you know, gets you down to, you have some chance of approaching curing half the addicts. Okay. Now, you know, I think that the point is to if that information is fairly clear. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a gap. If the difference between your plan and something is 1 or 2%, politically, it don't, especially where budgets are involved, it ain't going to cut it. Okay. It doesn't matter what it is. Doesn't matter whether it's better or not. But the case for a demonstrable change in outcomes, okay, that would then have an impact on the social costs. So then you can make an argument to Pete Doherty, the sheriff, right, or this fellow in Martinsburg, maybe, or anybody else. Okay, hey, look, you know, the scientific, you know, evidence and the data shows that if we go this way, we make progress. If we do this other stuff, you're blowing smoke.
I'm looking forward to meeting the chief of police, because when you talk to these patients who are sometimes very, very deep into addiction, and you ask them when it started, a very large number of them started when they were 13. Sometimes right. 12, sometimes 14, right. But all around 13. Mm-hmm. Well, most of us guys, and I think the ladies too, I'm not sure, remember being 13. Mm-hmm. For me, it was awful. Okay. Yeah. It's a rough time, and I'm not aware, other than the chief of police Martinsburg initiative, I'm not aware of anyone addressing this reality to the disease. If you start smoking cigarettes when you're 13, your chance of stopping later in life is very low.
Yeah.
If you start smoking when you're 20, 22 years old, your chance of stopping is very good. We know this about this disease.
I started at 17, quit at 40.
Okay, well, and starting at 17 is better than starting at 13, but it's not as good as starting.
Started at 21, quit when I was 48, started back again, quit again, started back again, and now I'm in the process of quitting again.
You've never quit.
Don't say that.
But
progress, not perfection.
But thanks, John.
But what he's trying
I'm the counter psychiatrist here. Okay.
Yeah.
What the Martinsburg Initiative is doing is addressing head on the fact that if we ignore the 13-year-olds, we're really not accomplishing what we're trying to accomplish, and that's good. Now, my problem is this treatment word. When the word treatment comes up, we have to all be talking on the same language. It's one thing to say that we recommend people go into evidence-based treatment. Okay, here's a phone call for a 6-month waiting line. That's not accomplishing a lot.
No.
So if in fact, and you know, you want the data supporting what I'm saying, that this is the effect of management, but when CDC, DEA, FDA, SAMHSA, everybody says the same thing, probably someone else has done this, but I'll try to get the information for you too.
However, they're not writing the check for the cost of doing it. Okay. So someone's got to write a check to pay for doing it.
Well, in many, many cases, the government is writing the check anyway, and they are the government also.
Well, because of the social costs?
No. They are very, very conscious about cost effectiveness. Modern medicine, and they can represent some parts of modern medicine, are very effective. Cost effectiveness is a very real issue. If, in fact, it was tremendously expensive and not cost effective, it's easier just to ignore the problem, they probably wouldn't take these strong stands. But what's impressive when you look at the articles written under these groups, they're saying the same thing, that this medication-assisted treatment is, in fact, what must be pushed.
Right. And okay. I can see where you're going to provide medical care for, you know, 50 people that they can't pay for. That's going to be a budget item.
As opposed to them going to jail.
You know, the state doesn't account things
I realize,
okay?
I realize
The prison lobby and the healthcare lobby are not the same people. And, you know, and I think they're, and also their preferred people that they like to talk to in the state legislature are not the same people either. I mean, you got a bunch of people that think the addicts should just die.
We also have a bunch of people who parents who want their children to go to jail so they'll get off drugs. So there is a connection.
If there's no other way to get off, I can understand some parent. I mean, again, it's a dead end solution, obviously. But on the other hand, people have no choices at certain points, right?
No, it's true. You know, I mean, there were times when there was nothing else available for the addicted person in the rural part of Florida, and if they would go to jail. You know, we would just try to get the case managers on top of it so that as soon as they were released, you know, they were back at the clinic for evaluation and see how we could assist them. But, it's a sad situation. Of course, we didn't have Vivitrol back then, the long-acting injection to counter the cravings. John, your point is well taken that how to convince the powers that be that money they're spending on that bed, the three hots and the cot in the jail, would be so much more effectively spent, you know, giving them treatment. I have actually seen studies that show that it's a whole lot cheaper than what we're spending, you know, paying these prison corporations, you know, for... The inmates, but convincing you know politicians to side against the lobbyists and so forth. You know, I just saw the documentary 13th. Have you seen that documentary?
I haven't seen it. I've heard about it.
Yeah, I mean, talking about the prison industrial system in this country and how we're up, you know, we're up above like 2 million inmates. There are more people incarcerated now than were slaves at the time of emancipation.
Jesus, I mean, this is it's out of control. I mean, unfortunately, I don't know what we're going to do about it.
Mostly black and brown. Yeah,
as it is now.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. And as it was before.
Right.
It's really just too much.
Too much. You know, John Aldis, Dr. Aldis, John said something that made me think of a question for you. You know, you're aware of some of the folks that, you know, and practitioners even in the area, some of whom we admire, who are, you know, proponents of this holistic kind of approach or what they call holistic approach. I call it, you know, holistic minus a little peg, a little corner, you know, a fourth of the pie. Could you speak to that? What are they advocating? How are they convinced that taking out the medication-assisted treatment portion of the treatment is effective?
See, most of the people who are proposing these things are actually proposing things that are fairly effective as adjunctive therapy, as additional therapy, as therapy in addition to what is normally called a medication-assisted treatment. Nobody's going to object to a lot of the things that are proposed in that context. Sending somebody to a very expensive long-term rehab program is an excellent idea. They learn to talk the talk. They learn the language. They learn about the disease. They come out of there speaking another language as they're walking off to the nearest heroin dealer to get their next fix. But the point is, the value, there is a value to that. There's no question about it. Okay, and they. I want that to continue. I saw a Facebook note somebody wrote about somebody who finally had seen the light and was on the road to recovery. 14 rehab programs. 14. And this is considered a success because now she has seen the light after 14 long-term rehab programs. Mm-hmm. So I'm not against the rehab program. I think it should be done in concert with medication-assisted treatment.
Right. So, there's lots of versions of the of that syndrome. I'll give you one that seems very far afield, but I actually believe is philosophically the same. We used to have a very militant anti-war movement in the town of Buffalo, in 1968 to 70. Put 10,000 people in the street.
Wow.
That's a lot of people in Buffalo, New York, let me tell you. Okay, and it got everybody's attention. However, it got the attention of the people that wanted to repress that kind of thing as well. And so it got to be a little bit dangerous leading those demonstrations in one way or another. Lots of unforeseen matters that came up. And so then I would hear people, there was a certain faction of that, the peace movement, that decided not to be part of the movement, but to go live peacefully. And, you know, I mean, and I saw that happened also, you know, at certain times in the civil rights movement.
We know some of those people.
Who decided to, who were active, but then it got a little dangerous. Mm-hmm. And they decided to live a colorblind life.
A colleague of mine, Dr. David.
A colorblind life, you know, where
colorblind, yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's a tendency, you know, in all kinds of things where you have a difficult question that comes up where it's going to take money to fix. Mm-hmm. I believe this is where the rub always tends to come, or it starts there. It doesn't always take that direct form, but you get up to the point, oh, gee, doing what Dr. Aldous says requires that the budget would have to be changed. Mm-hmm. And we'd have to invest that. And then so certain people, well, that's a complicated political battle right there, you've just asked, because budgets don't, they either come from something, some other part of a budget, like you're talking about, that's trade off some prison funds for healthcare,
right,
okay?
Right.
Or they involve a tax increase,
right.
Which everybody with, you know, the over probably $150,000 will oppose on principle, you know, until you beat them their head into the ground over it, you know. So
until their kids are dying,
and there'll be the propaganda will start. Well, the opposition will come out, and the people who favored this reform will say, "Oh, well, there's an easier way."
Mm-hmm.
There's a very strong. There must be an easy, more comfortable way to solve this problem. And then I sort of see a sort of similarity in these. Fear has an political fears have a very interesting impact on people's ideas.
I had a colleague. I have a colleague, Dr. David Bloom, and he's anti-tobacco, and he is really, really good on being anti-tobacco on all sorts of levels. And this started way back in the 70s when I first met him. So he's big into this. And a friend, a colleague of his, once commented, "He's so anti-tobacco. He's anti-tobacco."
Yeah. Yeah, right. Right, that's right, man. I heard that. Well, yeah. Well, anyways.
You know, John, Dr. Aldous, I was thinking that could the irony be that the pushback you're getting about the use of medication-assisted treatment, about using methadone and Suboxone, is because the community has now gotten it that opioids are bad, that these things that they thought were, you know, sort of innocuous and benign, that the doctor gives you for physical pain after surgery, etc., chronic arthritis, that it's a really dangerous stuff. And so we're kind of having this, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Well, that's bad, so the other things must be bad, too.
Absolutely. This trading one narcotic for another is the classic line I get hit with all the time.
Right.
And I understand that perspective. And I also know that if I have a person very stable on Suboxone and I try to reduce the dosage, I know what happens. The patient does badly. This is a fact.
Mm-hmm.
So now we've got a problem on our hands. We've replaced their heroin with another narcotic, and they're doing well. They've got their lives back. They're taking care of their children. They're going to school. They've got their jobs. Everything's great.
Yeah.
Okay? But then you try to get them off that, and they do poorly. They really do poorly. The only medication of the three medications which is not a narcotic is called Vivitrol, which is a long, it's a repository, long-acting shot you get once a month deep in your butt. It's pretty effective, and patients do well on that as long as they keep coming back to get the shot. But I found after 3 or 4 months or 5 months, if you're lucky, they stop coming back. and the disease, in some cases, I'm afraid many cases, doesn't work that way. This particular treatment is very popular with the judicial system. The judges love it because it's not one narcotic replacing another narcotic.
Yeah.
We're not letting these people get high. It blocks the high you get from opiates. So this is good. We're keeping these people from getting high. Jesus. But the sad part about it is, though, that it's not something you can easily keep them on year after year. The patient just doesn't want it.
Because of the shot?
No, I don't think so. They may give that excuse, but no, I don't think so.
What is it they don't like about it?
It's not tweaking their mu receptors the same way that the buprenorphine is. I hate to say it, but that's what it is.
So have you tried, in addition to the Vivitrol monthly, sub-therapeutic doses of Suboxone?
I would love to try that. That would be pure research.
Yeah.
And it would be a very interesting
study. But you know
what,
John? I bet they're doing it all over the place and just not talking about it. I'm absolutely certain that their treatment centers are doing that. I mean, polypharmacy was this dirty word back in my early days practicing psychiatry. Like, if you had someone on one antidepressant, oh God, you never put them on another mind or mood altering drug. And now that's standard of care. You know, if one antidepressant doesn't work, you know, gets their depression lifted, maybe 50%, augment it with another antidepressant or another form of medication to get more bang out of the buck. But so we're way behind the curve, aren't we?
Well, one of the difficulties with naltrexone is a potent blocker of the mu receptor. It is 100% blocker of the mu receptor, which is the main receptor that's responding to the buprenorphine or to the heroin or to the other opiates. Well, so that buprenorphine you might give them would have no place to go. It wouldn't get to the mu receptor. So we think, until it's tested, we don't know that.
That's right.
So, right. I think it's an excellent study, though, because a proposed study, because Vivitrol is a great drug, except, like I say, this long-term compliance just doesn't do as well. It's also good on alcoholism. It's an excellent drug for alcoholism. It for some reason, it's FDA approved for alcoholism and opiates, which is not a lot of drugs like that. But again, it's got to be given every month.
Yeah. You know, I share this story. Long-term acting medications through injections made me a hero in rural Florida.
That's right.
You know, I get out of, you know, training at NIH, and I know how to do this because, you know, we have a hospital full of chronic schizophrenics who come every month to get an injection, and they're stable. Because as every doctor knows, the number one cause of treatment failure is non-compliance.
That's right.
You give patients a prescription, 1 month, 3 months of pills, and they're maybe taking a third of it at that. You know, and yet they will come into your office and say, oh, yeah, I take it religiously every day, morning and night, I take it.
Yeah.
You know, I like to tell this story about this young ex-Marine who had schizophrenia, who I had been seeing for several years. Every 3 months, give him 90-day supply of the antipsychotic. For some reason, I said, you know what? Bring me your bags of medicine when you come. Bring me all the medicines you have at home, all the over-the-counter and stuff. Well, he brings in a big shopping bag with like a year's supply of his medication. And I said to him, you have all this extra medication. I said, every 3 months when I say, do you need a prescription, you tell me yes. Well, why did you say yes? He said, well, I don't know. He said, I figured you want to give me a prescription, I'll take a prescription.
Oh, God.
So, so the bottom line is...
Well, he was conning you on that, too.
Yeah, he was conning me, too. And but the other thing is, you know, periodically he was going to the state hospital for treatment or the crisis unit.
Yeah.
Put him on the monthly injections of schizophrenia. And when I left that clinic 5 years later, he'd never had a readmission. Ever, wow. You know, I mean, these things work. When people are actually getting the medication they need consistently,
you see results. Yeah.
So that's why I'm so interested in the idea of the Vivitrol, along with, you know, tweaking it, people being able to tweak it in between the shots with something if they feel a little, start feeling some symptoms.
Part of it is Vivitrol does not address the, and I use this word like everyone understands what it means, and I don't think they do, the cravings. Buprenorphine, somehow, because you're tweaking the mu receptor, is managing the cravings. Mm-hmm. Vivitrol is not doing it that well.
Okay.
Okay. And these cravings, I had one patient who I gave him his second shot, and I said, I'd see you in a month. And, well, I'm not sure. I said, well, what are you talking about? Why are you not sure? He looked at me eye to eye and said, Dr. Aldous, I really want to get high again.
Hmm.
Well, that's cravings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I mean,
exactly.
I've never had a Suboxone patient tell me that. So that's an interesting
difference.
Right. Also, someone actually did a study one time, in light of what you were just talking about there, did a study and determined the leading cause of hypertension in the United States is people aren't taking the medicines they were prescribed.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, noncompliance. Yeah. I mean,
guys, I got to run. Thank you so much.
Okay, Mike.
All right, buddy. Take care, Ben.
Thank you. And John Case, thank you so much for your optimistic outlook for my recovery. I appreciate it.
Hey, I had to quit smoking seven times before 40 in order to stop.
But it was really good talking with Dr. Zaki and Dr. Aldous.
Right.
Whatever, Case.
Yeah, right. Bye. Okay, man. All right, man. Keep smoking.
Keep Toadland croaking here.
Keep smoking, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, non-compliance. I mean, it's, you know, it's the number one cause.
Should there be some sort of punishment for the non-compliant, other than their bad health?
No, there's no punishment. But actually, you know, when we got savvy about this, we started ordering blood levels of medications. Like, you know, they actually developed blood levels for antidepressants and so forth. So, even though the patient was telling me they're taking it religiously, I could say, well, you know, I want to see if you're actually absorbing this. So let's get a blood level. And that often is the problem also. They may be taking it, but for some individual genetic reason, they're not absorbing the medication like the average person would. So then
that actually happens?
They're a patient who I've got to give this god-awful amount of the medication that, you know, that the auditors would look at me and say, whoa, that's way over the FDA recommended limits.
Yeah.
And I'd have to say, well, here's the blood level, okay, on a regular dose.
Right.
Okay, and here's the blood level on double the dose.
But you would have to know that before you would take the chance of prescribing that much, right? I mean,
well, John, honestly, you know, medicine is an art, not a science. And before we even had blood levels and so forth, you know, doctors sit with a patient and they know that they're generally suffering and yet they're getting what you think is an adequate dose of the medication and they don't have significant side effects. So you start
incrementing
to use your gut.
Yeah, sure.
And you say, okay, we're gonna bump this up some. Let's try increasing this a little bit this week. Come back and see me.
Yeah.
Don't forget, those medications we get for schizophrenia, they don't make the person feel better. The patient doesn't come in the next week and say, God, I feel fantastic since I started taking that antipsychotic medication. In fact, sometimes it's exactly the opposite. And Zaki is a psychiatrist, knows this, that sometimes their fantasy worlds are very important to them, and you've just taken those away. So there are some other complications with the psychiatric, long-term psychiatric medication.
No, that's very true. You know, in terms of hallucinations, we have what we call egosyntonic and egodystonic hallucinations. Egosyntonic hallucinations are voices that say awful things about you, tell you to do awful things. You know, a person feels really tortured by them. So you give them an antipsychotic and that quells it. And they come back and say, yeah, you know, they're quieter. I don't hear them as much. As opposed to the person who has egosyntonic hallucinations, who they comfort them. They say nice things about them. They feel like a friend. I mean, I actually had a patient like this. She called them her soothing spirits. And for them, you know, it's you took my soothing spirits away. You know, I don't like this medicine. Plus it, you know, it makes me feel jittery, or it makes me feel like a zombie, or, you know, it takes away my nature. You know, that was some nomenclature I had to learn in the Everglades. Doc, you done took away my nature.
I'm no longer a sexual Tyrannosaurus.
It's an art, not a science, right, John?
Well, I think that I hope that we can. I think putting together, though, I think it's important to put together a political case that is. You can't. Where enough of the facts point to a different trend, and also then you have the ability to assess costs differently in a fairly concrete way. I don't see how that would not be persuasive, except for you will now have isolated the one thing is, I don't care what it is, I don't want to pay any more taxes position, okay? Mm-hmm. Which is, okay, I mean, that's where every issue in society, addiction is only one of them, right, runs up against what kind of society are we actually going to have and what can we afford to do?
One really important point, and it got kind of buried earlier in my discussion. I think Zaki mentioned these holistic treatments, and you can also talk about a case management approach. Okay, somebody's got to get these people hired in a job. Somebody's got to help them with their restitution payments so they can get their driver's licenses
Rat
back.
Park.
Medicaid doesn't pay for any of that.
No, of course not.
Okay, but if you don't do that, you're not accomplishing real treatment. If you are not doing those things, nothing is really happening. So all of these, as you call them, holistic, all of these things, these wraparound approaches,
services
that nobody else is paying for, the government isn't paying for, the insurance company's not paying for, if those aren't there, nothing else good happens. So I don't want to blow these people away, these people who are trying to help. There's a lot they can do. It's just that I think they should do it in the context of modern medical management and supporting these patients when they're in modern medical management.
Absolutely. You know, rat cage versus rat park.
Right. Well, yeah, but remember, rat park costs more than rat cage.
Yeah, it does. But it's about returning a person to their life. You know, and I mean, can we look at the ripple effect for their children, for their spouses, for the community, you know, making them productive, you know, instead of destructive in their behavior patterns?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that that should be.
And you know, you have Republicans like Rand Paul who are speaking out against this excessive incarceration and, you know, and the toll that it's taken on our communities. So, you know, maybe there's some hope. I mean, there seems to be enough publicity out now about this mass incarceration, this prison industrial complex, and that it has to stop. And it's gotten the attention of, you know, some Republicans because, yeah, it's fiscally irresponsible. You know, it's really, you know, becoming costly. They're starting to get it that this is really costly warehousing people in prisons. You know, it's a shame that it had to take that, you know, to get, you know, to take a moral position about, you know, inappropriately warehousing people for minor offenses, for drug possession, you know, et cetera.
Sounds perfectly reasonable. I think there's a bunch of people that are tied into the prison industry, though, that are.
I agree.
Posing you there.
But, you know, when I went to a symposium at GW's law school and Rand Paul and Eric Holder spoke at the same on the same morning, you know, about the same issue. About we need to stop criminalizing everything and look at, you know, I said, well, you know, there's some hope here, maybe.
Not much.
Not much, okay.
I'm a downer today. Not much.
All right, let's end with a poem then.
Okay.
You got a poem?
Oh, I got lots of poems.
Okay.
You know,
I got one by a female, Arnie Evans, Harlem Renaissance.
We'll do that one then.
It's real short. So you cue up your poem. We'll end with your poem.
All right.
Her poem is, "If there be sorrow, let it be for things undreamed of, unrealized, unattained. To these add one, love withheld, restrained."
Oh, I like that one.
That's a good one.
Well, okay, I got one. I'll do another one by Maya Angelou was the poet that we opened up with this morning, by the way. So
I knew that.
Yeah, I knew you. I could tell you that. Yeah.
But this is talk about a phenomenal woman.
This is another one of her poems called "Woman Work." I've got the children to tend, and the clothes to mend, the floor to mop, and the food to shop. Then the chicken to fry, the baby to dry. Where was it? Oh, yeah. And I got company to feed, the garden to weed. I've got shirts to press, the tots to dress. This can to be cut, got to clean up this butt. Then see about the sick and the cotton to pick. Shine on me, sunshine. Rain on me, rain. Fall softly, dewdrops. And cool my brow again. Storm, blow me from here with your fiercest wind. Let me float across the sky till I can rest again. Fall gently, snowflakes, cover me with white. Cold, icy kisses, and let me rest tonight. Sun, rain, curving sky, mountain, oceans, leaf and stone, star shine, moon glow. You are all that I can call my own.
Beautiful. Beautiful. To women everywhere, we salute you.
All right. International Women's Day. Everybody, we'll be playing some music here, but coming up in about an hour is Stuart Acuff's Resistance Radio. I forget what he's doing today, but I'm sure he'll tell us.
You know it's good.
It'll be good. He's on fire. He's just on fire, you know. Anyway, all right, everybody. Take care. Thank you, Dr. Aldous. Thank you, Dr. McGill. And everybody, take care of each other. It's late, but everything comes next.